folks. So I guess about two-thirds of the class is taking this class online. Is that what is happening right now? Where is everybody? Okay. So wherever they are, I don't know where they are. So the quizzes, the last of the quizzes are still upstairs. So if you haven't picked them up, please do pick them up as soon as you can. Because, in fact, pick them up right after class today. If you haven't picked them up, because I have to bring them in, because I have the regular MBA quizzes to go out there. I can't let them get mixed up. So if you haven't picked it up, pick it up so that at least you can check the grading to make sure it's okay. And not picking it up is not going to make it go away. Okay? That is not the version of sunk cost we talked about. Okay? So it's okay to think of it as in the past, but you still need to recover your own past. You know, you can't just let it fade away. So what I'd like to do today, okay, is actually continue that trade-off on debt and equity and start to get specific. So the question we're trying to answer again, let me go back, because we've broken the session up over three sessions. It's kind of disjointed. So let me review where we are. We talked about the fact that every business has to make this decision of how much to borrow and how much equity to use. Small, large, private, public, U.S. emerging market, every company has to make this decision. Every business has to make this decision. So what we're looking at is what that trade-off is. And for much of the last three sessions, in little pieces, we've been looking at the trade-off. The two big benefits of debt, somebody remind me, what's the biggest benefit of debt, Roy? Tax benefit, which comes from the tax code. Yesterday I put up a weekly puzzle. If you get a chance, please look at it, because this is actually the U.S. Treasury's latest attempt to stop what are called inversions. You know what an inversion is? A U.S. company buys an Irish company and merges with an Irish company and moves its headquarters to Ireland. What does it gain from doing it? It actually doesn't reduce its tax rates on U.S. income to 12.5%, but what it allows them to do is all their global income that comes out of the U.S. gets taxed at that country's tax rate. The U.S. has this very strange, it's called a global tax system. There are only six countries in the world that have this system. You know what the global tax system requires you to do as a U.S. company? You have to pay the U.S. tax rate on all of the income you make in the world, no matter where that income is. So if you make income in Hong Kong, you get taxed at 15%, but the U.S. actually requires you to pay the 40% that's a U.S. tax rate, with one little glitch. That 25% extra tax has to be paid only when the money comes back to the U.S. Who writes stupid laws like this? Because you know exactly what companies are now going to do, right? If you're going to tax me 25% the minute the money comes back to the U.S., what am I going to do? I'm going to leave it outside the U.S. Hence is born the phenomenon of trapped cash. If you ever hear the words trapped cash, there's $2 trillion right now in trapped cash. You say, when I first read this, I said, who's trapping it and where is it? I'd like to get there. Here's why it's trapped. Because as long as the U.S. tax law is what it is, that money is trapped. It cannot be used to pay dividends. It cannot be used to buy back stock. It cannot be used to make investments in the U.S. But guess what it can be used for? You can invest anywhere else in the world. Talk about unintended consequences, right? So the same U.S. legislators who say U.S. companies are not investing very much in the U.S. have actually written a tax law that encourages companies to invest anywhere but the U.S. And of course, the minute you invert, what happens is you go from a global tax system to a regional tax system, which means that your taxes in the U.S. still might get taxed at 40%, but your tax income elsewhere gets taxed at whatever the local rate is, which can save you significant amount. But the other thing that comes out of it is the minute you become an Irish company, what happens to all that trapped cash? It's untrapped now. You can do whatever you want with it. You know how much trapped cash Apple alone has as a company? $140 billion. Think about that, $140 billion. If tomorrow Apple became a Singaporean corporation, hey, nothing to stop you. It's, you know, just move from one infinite loop in Silicon Valley to Singapore. The minute you do that, the $140 billion is money you can use on whatever you want. We're laying a golden path for U.S. companies to leave the U.S. That's what we're doing. And we're pushing them out, saying, go away. Yes, it started this week. The U.S. Treasury decided it was going to try to slow the process down. It can't really stop it by passing laws that made this inversion process more problematic. And actually, the laws were written to stop one big merger. You know which one it was? The Pfizer-Allergan. It actually worked. Pfizer is not too. Okay. But you know what? All you need to do is modify the inversion. This process can't be stopped because the underlying problem is still there. To make this problem go away, there are only one of two solutions. One is the U.S. has to go to the same tax model that the rest of the world adopts, which is a regional tax model where you get taxed based on wherever you make the income at the local tax rate. What's the other? They've got to lower the tax rate to the tax rate of the rest of the world, right? You have two problems there. One or the other will fix the problem. Roy? Well, that's a different problem. That's for income that is they're trying to evade tax on. This has nothing to do with evading taxes. You're actually paying taxes on wherever you make the money. Those tax-free zones are when you sell products and services that don't have a regional. If you sell a car, I can see where you sell it, right? If you sell music from the iTunes store, where exactly are you selling it from? You see the problem with these companies that are selling products and services that don't have a physical body to them? It's easier for them to say, we're selling it all from Irish space. And that's why all the technology companies have these Irish double. You know, last year when I was in Dublin, I tried to do this, create a Irish subsidiary of myself. Because I wanted to try this. Companies can do it. Why? The problem is, as an individual, this law applies even if you're a U.S. individual. Do you know that? You go to work in Bermuda. What's the tax rate in Bermuda? It's 0%. Unless you're a U.S. citizen. In which case, you have to take your Bermuda income and pay 40% or 45%. You see the next step, right? You're at some point going to say, why am I a U.S. citizen? It's almost like they put you on the spot. Say, how much do you value the U.S. citizenship? Is it 3 million? Is it 5 million? Is it 7 million? Is it 15 million? Going, going, gone. It's a stupid system. There is no other word I can use to describe it. It's a stupid system because it makes you essentially play by a different set of rules than everybody else in the world is playing. Okay? So it has to change. The problem is, politically, neither side wants to budge because it's great populist language. It wins elections on both sides. So nobody wants these things to change. So on that very, very pessimistic note, take a look at yesterday's puzzle because it's all about this issue. Okay? So the biggest benefit is a tax benefit. The secondary benefit you get is added discipline. Remember what we said about that? Some companies, by forcing managers to borrow money, you're going to make them more disciplined about taking projects. Because if they take a bad project, then they face the problem of losing their jobs. On the other side of the balance sheet, you have three costs. The first is an expected bankruptcy cost. And think intuitively of what I'm saying. If you borrow money, there's a greater chance you could get into trouble than if you don't borrow money. That's true for everything you do. So there's an expected bankruptcy cost, which is going to be a function of the probability that you will have trouble making payments and the cost of bankruptcy. Remind me again what the cost of bankruptcy is. There's a direct cost which comes from where? From the fact that you end up in the legal system. Sucks up money like nobody's business. The other is the indirect cost where you're perceived to be in trouble and that creates a spiral effect where customers stop buying your products, suppliers start demanding cash, and employees leave. The second cost is an agency cost. So visualize yourself as a babysitter. You kind of get it, right? The agency cost comes from the fact that what equity investors want and what lenders want are very different things. And because they want different things, when you go out and borrow money as a company, you're going to find covenants put on you, restrictions on what you can or cannot do. That's got to be factored in. And there's a third and final cost, which is every time you borrow money, you give up some future flexibility. To do what? To use that debt to cover an unexpected need. In other words, if you use up debt capacity today, what happens if you have a bad year tomorrow and you need, or next year, and you need to go out and borrow money? And here again, I'm going to draw a distinction. If you're in a company, if you're a company in a stable business where your investment needs are pretty predictable, you might not care about the fact that you're losing flexibility. But if you're in a company in a very, you know, unstable business where things can change quickly, you can see why you might hold back. So when you look at your company, that's basically what you're looking at, is those factors. So let's see if companies actually care about this. This is actually the result of a survey where CFOs were asked, when you go out and raise financing, what are some of the things that you factor in as critical factors in deciding whether to borrow money or use equity? So this is across CFOs. I'm not saying this is the right thing to do. This is what they weight into their decision. Number one factor, they said, is maintaining flexibility. Companies want the flexibility to change their minds, number one. Number two is ensuring long-term survival. You don't want to put that at risk. Number three, you want to maintain a predictable source of funds because it's not just one year. It's every year you've got to raise capital. Number four, you want to maximize your stock price. So somewhere, so I'm glad it shows up at least in the top seven list. Number five, maintain financial independence. You want to be able to make decisions for yourself rather than have other people make them for you. Number six, they want to maintain a high debt rating. And number seven, they want to look like everybody else in the sector. So if you listen to CFOs, all of the things we talked about are in that list, but maybe not in the order that you might think they should be. So let's try this for my company. So basically what I'm going to do, if you think about the trade-off here, you've got tax benefits and added discipline on the left-hand side, expected bankruptcy costs, agency costs, and loss of flexibility on the other side. So when I look at a company and I ask the question, should my company borrow money, I'm going to start with this qualitative trade-off. So let me take my four companies, Tata Motors, Disney, Vale, and Baidu, and look at how the trade-off works on each of them. Let's start with the tax benefit. Among my four companies, Disney and Bookscape are going to have the biggest tax benefit from debt because they're in the U.S. They get a 40% tax benefit every time they make an interest payment. Tata Motors gets a 32.5% tax rate benefit because that's what the marginal tax rate in India is. And Vale has this very strange system. It's part of the Brazilian tax system. And the Brazilian tax code, while it has a 34% marginal tax rate, also allows you a partial tax saving when you issue equity. It's one of the few tax systems in the world that tries to even things out. How does it work? It takes your book equity, which you have from your balance sheet. It applies a rate to it that the government set. So this year it's 11.5%. So you take 11.5% of your book equity and you can deduct it just like you did interest expenses. You're saying, what does that do? It reduces the tax benefit of debt. So holding all else constant, you'd expect Vale to borrow less money than Disney or Bookscape. When it comes to added discipline, the company that probably needs it the most is Disney. Have you been reading the news stories coming out of Disney? Come on, guys. You can't let the Wall Street Journal go. That's part of this class, too. Tom Staggs, who was supposed to step in when Bob Iger stepped down, left the firm early this week. It was a complete surprise. There's a vacuum right now. And remember what I said at the start of the class when we talked about Bob Iger extending? This is a direct consequence of Iger not leaving as he planned to do in 2014. Remember the board begged him and said, you are so indispensable, you can't leave, and he listened? He's created consequences now for himself. So I have zero sympathy when he complains, because by staying on longer, the people who would have stepped in 2014 left the firm because they said, we're not waiting for this guy. And now they have a vacuum. There are consequences when CEOs overstep their bounds. So added discipline, I think Disney is the best case. You're saying, why don't Baidu and Tata Motors benefit? Because Baidu, the founder, is also the CEO. He has 25% of the shares. So you would assume that he has his own interests at heart. He doesn't need debt to make him more disciplined. And who owns a big chunk of Tata Motors? The Tata Group. So when they do screwy things, it's their family group money that is affected. So there again, I feel the need for debt is much smaller. When you look at expected bankruptcy costs, Baidu has the highest variance in earnings. It's a young technology company. Okay. Tata Motors and Vale are affected for a different reason. One is the cyclical companies. The economy gets stronger or weaker, the earnings get affected. Vale is affected by iron ore prices. Remember, iron ore prices were $100 per ton just 4 years ago. Now they're down to 35. Indirect bankruptcy costs are likely to be highest at Tata Motors. Why? When you get on a search engine, do you wonder, is this a AAA rated search? You don't really don't care. You want to search for something, you find it, then you move on. When you buy an automobile, do you see why you care? If the company's not going to be around in 3 years, who's going to supply the parts for this automobile? Much bigger indirect bankruptcy costs. Same thing with Disney. When you walk into a theme park, say, is today AAA-rated theme park? You're going to be there for the day. As long as they haven't been holding back on maintenance on the rides, you're going to be okay. Agency costs, highest at Baidu because you have no idea what they're doing. They claim to be doing research, but how do you know? It's probably lower at Vale and Tata Motors because you have physical assets. And at Disney, it probably varies across the company because if you lend against movies or broadcasting shows, you have no idea what they're doing. But if you're lending against a theme park, you have a physical asset to back it up. In terms of flexibility, Baidu, I think, will value flexibility the most simply because of the kind of business it's in. The other companies are more established. They should not need flexibility as much. What I'd like you to do, now that the quiz is done and the case is done, is go back and rediscover the project. I know you haven't looked at it, you don't even remember what it is, but there was this company, remember 8 weeks ago, a long time ago, you picked a company and you told me you picked a company, you've forgotten what the company is. I hope you wrote it down somewhere. What I'd like you to do is take your company through this prism. Think about the tax rate, think about it. So there's no right answer. At this stage, you're just doing a qualitative trade-off and ask yourself after the trade-off, given what I find out about my company, would I expect it to borrow a lot of money, not very much money, and no money at all? It's a surprisingly powerful tool for making that judgment. Any questions? So now we have the trade-off. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to put you in a hypothetical world, a Twilight Zone episode, one of my favorite shows of all time. You wake up tomorrow, here's what the world looks like. Nobody pays taxes. This is like Greece. No, but that's a different reason. Nobody pays taxes, even though there's a tax code. Here, nobody pays taxes because nobody has to pay taxes. So think Bermuda. You're saying, okay, this is good, especially as April 18th approaches. Second, in this world, assume that managers have the best interests of stockholders at heart. In other words, they look at projects and they make their best assessments. It's not that they don't make mistakes, but they don't deliberately take bad projects. Third, firms in this universe never go bankrupt. So there's no taxes, no firm ever defaults. Fourth, equity investors in this world are honest. Remember that little exercise we went through last session where I made you go borrow from the bank and you lied through your teeth? You told them you were going to take a safe project, then took a risky project. In this world, you would go tell them the truth. If you're going to take a risky project, it's a really risky project, we want to let you know right away. And in this world, every firm knows what it needs in financing for the next 10, 15, 20 years. You ready? Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take you back to that trade-off I showed you on debt. And in this world, I want you to think about what that trade-off looks like. So help me out here. What do the tax benefits look like in this world? None. So that's zero. So just put a big zero next to it. What about added discipline? Why don't I need it? Because managers already do the right thing. So you have zero benefits, zero added discipline. So there are no tax benefits, no added discipline. What about expected bankruptcy costs? No company ever goes bankrupt, zero. What about agency costs? What did I say about equity investors? They never lie. If you never lie, I don't need to put covenants on you because you're going to tell me the truth. And who needs financial flexibility when you know all your financing needs for the next 25 or 30 years? So you have zero tax benefits, zero added discipline, zero bankruptcy cost, zero agency cost, and zero future flexibility. So what happens when you borrow money in this world? You get no benefits, you have no costs. So how much can you borrow? Or how much should you borrow as a company? So if you borrow a dollar, your value stays unchanged. You borrow $100, your value stays unchanged. You borrow $1 billion, your value stays unchanged. So how much should you borrow? It doesn't matter. You've just derived corporate finance's most famous theorem. It's called the Miller-Modigliani theorem. Remember I told you corporate finance is 57 years old? 1958 paper, Merton Miller and Franco Modigliani. That's the Miller-Modigliani theorem. In a world with no taxes, no default risk, and no agency problems, it does not matter how much you borrow. Notice all the qualifiers added. No taxes, no default risk. One of the great tragedies of the Miller-Modigliani theorem, Merton Miller and Franco Modigliani won the Nobel Prize for this. And it's an incredible accomplishment. They actually structured the debt trade-off for the first time, because until 1958, if you ask companies how much should you borrow, they said, well, whatever everybody else is doing. They structured the trade-off. But the tragedy of the Miller-Modigliani theorem is there are generations of business school students. If you ask them, what's the only thing you remember about the capital structure lectures, they will say the Miller-Modigliani theorem. How convenient. I don't remember any of it, but it doesn't matter anyway. In fact, it's amazing how often I run into bankers who use the Miller-Modigliani theorem like garlic with a vampire. Every time you talk about debt, Miller-Modigliani, back off, don't talk about debt, Miller-Modigliani. Okay? And to show you how absurd this fixation with the Miller-Modigliani is, I'll tell you a story. The very first corporate finance class I taught at Stern was in 1986, the fall of 86. And one of the students from that class ended up going to work for an LBO outfit, which was actually involved in the leveraged buyout of Bloomingdale's. And when they did that LBO, it never made sense to me. Think about it. Bloomingdale's is a high-end retailer, right? Earnings are going to be up and down depending on what the economy is doing. It's not the kind of business I would expect you to load up with debt on. But they did. In fact, their fatal problem was the lead investor on that deal was a lunatic. And I'm not just doing this as an insult. He was mentally unstable. A guy called Robert Campbell. But he did good deals, and bankers can't resist even crazy deal makers. So, oh, good deal. They did the deal fell apart, and LBO outfits went bankrupt right and left, including this guy's outfit. So he loses his job, ends up on his feet somewhere else on Wall Street. 4 or 5 years later, run into him on somewhere on Wall Street and ask him what he's been doing, and he says, I used to work for this LBO outfit. And I remember the name. I said, weren't you guys involved in that Bloomingdale's? He's very proud. He says, yes, yes. I said, why the heck would you pick a company like Bloomingdale's to borrow all that money on? He looked at me like I had two heads and said, don't you remember the Miller-Modigliani theorem? I said, yes. He said, didn't they say it didn't matter how much you borrowed? I said, yes, and I'm glad you live in a world with no taxes and no default risk. Remind me again, though, what happened to the outfit that you used to work for without a trace of irony. He said it went bankrupt. You see what the irony is? He's talking about the Miller-Modigliani theorem, and one of the central building blocks is nobody goes bankrupt. In the same sentence almost, he's saying, so let's be realistic. In the world that you and I live in, there are taxes, there is default risk, there are agency problems. You can use the Miller-Modigliani theorem as one end of the spectrum, but to argue that it doesn't matter how much you borrow is beyond absurd. It makes no sense. So what we're going to talk about is what to do about this. Because the Miller-Modigliani theorem is a very convenient theorem. Why is it convenient? Because the cost of capital for your company will be the same at every debt ratio. So if you tell me what it is at no debt, it'll be at because debt makes no difference. It'll be flat. The world we live in, that's not the way things look. So what I'm going to start with actually is looking at how companies raise financing. Because there are preferences that companies have. They like to raise financing in certain ways, and we're going to talk about why. And then talk about tools we can use to decide what the right mix of debt and equity is, rather than fall back on Miller-Modigliani and say, do whatever you want. So let's start with this financing hierarchy question. When you look at how companies make financing decisions, and I showed you that list of what managers look at, The two things managers seem to value the most when it comes to making financing choices is they value flexibility. They want to be able to do whatever they want without having people question them. And they value control. They don't want to answer to anybody. Human nature, right? You're a manager. You want to use financing that gives you flexibility and you don't have to answer to anybody. If you use that reasoning, let's think about if you run a business, you're the CFO, what's your best way of raising financing? You don't have to answer to anybody and you really don't have to worry about giving up control. Yes? Actually, it's not your own money. It's your shareholders' earnings that you reinvest. Retained earnings is by far the best way to fund projects because you don't have to go in front of a bank and show them numbers. You don't have to explain to anybody. Your stockholders might ask you, why didn't you pay more dividends? But by the time they ask you the question, it's already too late. You've spent their money. So number one should be retained earnings. What do you think comes right below retained earnings? So let's say you want $100 million. $60 million comes from retained earnings. You're still $40 million short, so you need to come up with more money. What do you think the second best choice is going to be? And in fact, why debt as opposed to equity? Because as I thought through this, what, you know, yeah. And also you have to file that prospectus. You have to tell people what you're going to do. And then your analysts start asking you questions. What are you doing? Where are you issuing this money? Whereas with the debt, especially if you take it from if you issue bonds, I mean, you might have a few covenants, but bonds traditionally don't have that many. You might be more reluctant to borrow from a bank. In fact, let me show you the entire hierarchy. This is how, when CFOs are asked, where would you like to go money, this is the hierarchy they give you. Number one by far is retained earnings. It's not even close. Second best is straight debt, as opposed to what? Convertible or some special feature. So straight debt. Yeah.
Why would convertible be above common equity?
Why would what be above?
Convertible debt be above.
Because, and again, this is a survey. This is what they gave you. Why is convertible debt better than equity? Because if you issue convertible debt, the people who buy your debt are buying options, right? In a sense, they don't even care whether the project is a good project or a bad project. They care about upside. So you could actually take a project with a lot of upside, which is really not that good a project. And people will buy conversion options on it.
Exercising options makes it.
You don't even think about convert. See, this is the problem with convertibles. Is human nature is you know at some point in time it's going to be exercised, but it's in the future. That's why startups, when they go out and raise money, are so eager to use convertible preferred. Have you ever watched in Shark Tank, Kevin O'Leary? He's kind of a twisted mind, right? So this person will come up and present a business and Mark Cuban will say, I'll give you $100,000 for 10%. And Kevin O'Leary will say, I'll give you $100,000 for 3%, but I will take 20% of your profits every year in perpetuity and you pay me $7 for every item that you sell. Your mind goes, what the hell are you talking about? The reality is that Kevin O'Leary offer, you're actually effectively giving up more than 10%. But what your mind latches on to is, hey, I'm giving up only 3% today. It's psychological. It's a behavioral twist that you know something bad could happen to you in the future. But until it happens, you act like it's not going to happen. And the accountants aid and abet you, right? Because when you do your balance sheet, what do you show when you issue convertible debt? You just show debt. It shows up as debt until it gets converted into equity. It's a horrible way to record convertible debt. But I think that's a big deal here. It's part of the reason why convertible debt might actually show up above equity. So it's retained earnings, straight debt, convertible debt, new stock issues, and then at the bottom of the barrel, you got preferred stock. Why is preferred stock so much worse than straight debt? I mean, they both have fixed payments. One is interest expenses, the other is dividends. What makes preferred stock less attractive? Sorry? You don't have voting rights with debt either, right? You don't give voting rights with either. So you basically don't give up any control. The interest is tax deductible. Preferred dividends are not. So it's like issuing very expensive debt, if you think about it. It's really a crazy way to raise money. But the reason the biggest issuers of preferred stock do it, who are the biggest issuers of preferred stock? I might have mentioned this when we talked about preferred stock in passing. it's banks. You know why banks like to issue preferred stock? Is when regulatory capital ratios are computed for banks, and that's how they're regulated, preferred stock is counted as equity rather than debt. So it allows them to have their cake in a way and eat it too, because they can issue all this preferred stock, which is effectively expensive debt, but act like their equity just went up. Preferred stock, and the bottom of the list is convertible preferred. You're saying, what does this all mean? It has two consequences. One is, if you look at how companies raise money in the U.S., you can see the financing hierarchy kick in. So this is every year from 1975 through 2000. What I've done is I've computed what percentage of the financing for U.S. companies collectively comes from retained earnings. See this gray portion? That's retained earnings. By far, the bulk of the financing for U.S. companies comes from retained earnings. The blue is new debt issues, net new debt issues. This is debt issued minus debt repaid. That orange in the middle is new stock issues. Notice how small that is. U.S. companies, once they go public, are very reluctant to issue new shares. I'll give you an example. You know when Microsoft went public? Anybody know? 1986, right? That was 30 years ago. You know how many stock issues Microsoft has made since 1986? They've grown a lot, right? They've gone from a small company to a big company. They must have issued a lot of shares. Zero. They've never issued additional shares after their initial public offering. In fact, if U.S. companies issue shares, it's usually in the context of an acquisition where they give the shares to another company. But they almost never issue shares to the market. Why? Because of their financing hierarchy. CFOs don't like to give up control. They don't like to give up flexibility. And for some reason, they view stock issues as a drain on both. That's the first way to remember the hierarchy. It explains a lot of what companies do. Here's the other. You know what a tombstone ad is? What's a tombstone ad? It's actually in the paper to show everybody how great you are as a bank. So basically, the tombstone ad, you'd see the company issuing the security being issued, and the line of investment bankers all lined up saying, we helped them do it. You say, so what? If you get a chance this evening after class is over, pick up today's Wall Street Journal and leaf through it. There'll be a few tombstone ads. Look at the company. Make sure it's a company you've never heard of. It shouldn't be difficult because there are lots of companies we have no idea what they do. And look at the kind of security that they issue. And then try, given the security they've issued, try to guess how much financial trouble they're in. Okay. Yes, Justin. Convertible, you know how preferred works, right? It's a fixed dividend. So basically, when you buy regular preferred stock, I give you a 6% dividend in perpetuity. What's convertible debt allow you to do? Okay, does somebody want to explain what convertible in a convertible debt does? It basically allows you to convert the debt into equity at a fixed price. So right now it might not be sensible for you to do it, but if the stock price goes up, you can convert your debt into equity. So when you issue,
it's always the debt holder's choice.
It's a debt holder's choice. So you get an option. Under what conditions will you exercise the option? If the stock price shoots up, you might say, you know what, I don't want debt anymore. I'll become one of the equity investors. Exactly. It's a preferred stock that you can convert into common stock at your option as the holder of the stock. So let me give you an example of what I mean about this tombstone ad. Let's suppose you open up the journal and you see a tombstone ad for a company. Never heard of the company before, but you do see what kind of security the company is issuing. It's going to be issuing convertible preferred stock. I won't let you look at the 10K or the annual report. That's not fair. But I say, hey, can you tell me whether this company is in good financial shape or not? Can you make that guess based on what they're issuing? Where are they going? They're going to the very bottom of the barrel. Why are you going to the bottom of the barrel? Because there's nothing at the top of the barrel. You say, why can't they use retained earnings? I'll wager this company is losing money like crazy. You say, why don't they borrow money? Because they have a triple C rating. So why didn't they issue convertible debt? Well, convert into what? Your stock price is collapsing. You see how one by one your options start to dissipate? If today Valiant wanted to issue some kind of security to raise money, you see how desperate you're going to have to get to convertible preferred? It's actually so pick five tombstone ads and make that guess. Go check the financials then. See whether it works. It's actually surprisingly effective at telling you what companies use. What do a lot of young startups use to raise financing? Convertible preferred. Why do they use it? Desperation time. As you get more financially healthy, the other options will open up. Justin?
Why is convertible preferred
worse than preferred? Because in addition to offering a fixed dividend, with time, if you actually succeed, what are you going to have to give up? A share of your company too. At least with convertible preferred, you have a fixed dividend. And if things go really well, you get to keep the money as the equity investor. But with convertible preferred, things go really well, that preferred stockholder will convert and become an equity investor. You get 15% of your company. Exactly, at your option. So what you do is you collect the cash flow. The company is not doing well, so just pay me the money, pay me the money. And if they do really well, you say, give me 15% of your company. So you get the best of both worlds. You get a fixed cash flow if they're not doing that well, and you get the rest of the company or a big piece of the company if they do. I'm just waiting for Kevin O'Leary to offer a convertible on the Shark Tank. It's one of my favorite shows. I sit there and I try to guess the value of businesses. Then I try to guess how much these people are going to be offering. It actually makes it an active exercise. You can't sit there eating potato chips then. You got to have a little piece of paper in your hands. What's the estimated value? Let's see if I can work it out. It's actually fun because it brings into practice everything we talked about, thinking about what it is that drives the values of businesses and why people offer what they do. Yes, Roy? He has offered convertibles? He's a very slippery character. You're dead to me kind of thing. I love that expression. You're dead to me, you're dead to me. You know, but he's also extraordinarily rude. So there are all those other things that come with offering convertibles, I guess. So it's a classic venture capitalist. So now let's talk about capital structure. I'm sorry? Oh, yeah. Tombstone ads are actually after the fact. So by the time a tombstone ad's been put in, they're not asking you to invest based on the ad. That's not what's causing... The tombstone ad is really after the transaction. So the actual selling gets done by bankers on phones to portfolio managers. The tombstone ad is just to tell the rest of the world, look how great we are. We raise financing. So nobody actually looks at the Wall Street Journal and says, I'd like to buy convertible preferred. Let me call. There's no phone number you can call in there. So it's actually not designed for you and I to read the paper and send money in. It's really to let us know that they've already decided to go to the market to raise money. So tombstone ad is just a public relations. It's an ad. That's what it is. Yeah. Yes? Well, it depends on the business, right? If I always came up with higher values, that's a bias problem that I have. And higher than who? Than the venture capitalist? Probably higher, simply because they're going to lowball the numbers, right? I mean, Kevin O'Leary does stupid things like it should be 6x EBITDA. Awful metric if you're looking at a young startup. Okay? But he has these little metrics that he uses. Oh, you should really be 3 million, not 30 million. But it's a TV show, so you got to kind of take it for what it's worth. I will wager that even Mark Cuban is not that savvy about valuing companies. You see, but he's rich. One company, right? He basically took that company, he sold it at its peak, he sold at the peak of the dot-com boom at $5 billion. You know what the value of that company went to right after boom bust? It went to $200 million. So his skill was that he sold at the right time. And of course, his next biggest success was Dallas Mavericks. He bought them for $150 million, and that franchise is now worth $2.5 billion or $3 billion, right? So it's two big. He has had two big wins in his life, and much of what the rest of it he's done is kind of you tread water. So, You know, so I wouldn't take much of what they're doing more for more than what it's worth. It's a negotiating game rather than a valuation game from their perspective. But it's still fun to watch. Right? So let's talk about finding the right mix of debt and equity. So what I'm going to focus on is essentially this box. What's the right mix for you? And you see, we've already talked about that at a qualitative level. So if you do this pluses and minuses of debt and say, how much should your company borrow, you can't really answer that question in specific terms by saying 35% debt, 40, 45% debt. So I'm going to give you five ways of coming up with the right mix of debt and equity for a company. In fact, one of these five ways I already talked about, you tell me where your company is in the life cycle, I can kind of guess how much debt you should have. Okay? But there are four other approaches I want to take you through. The first is the cost of capital approach. Hey, we've already talked about cost of capital, right? But in what context? In investment analysis, what role does the cost of capital play? It's a minimum acceptable hurdle rate you need to make to take an investment, right? I'm going to use the cost of capital in a different context. I'm going to tell you it's a tool you can use to tell me what the right mix of debt and equity is, so I'll take you through that. That approach has been around a long time. It comes with a lot of caveats. There are assumptions we make that are not quite realistic. So the second approach is a variant that I'm going to call the enhanced cost of capital approach, where I'm going to take care of some of the limitations of the traditional approach and take you through that approach. The third approach is called the adjusted present value approach, or the APV approach. Well, what you do is you separate debt from the rest of the company and you look at the benefits and costs of debt in dollar value terms and say, does it make sense for me to borrow money? And the fourth approach is what I think most companies use. If you ask me, why do companies borrow the way they do? The answer is, it's Me Too corporate finance. What's Me Too corporate finance? You look at what everybody else in the sector is doing and you say, Me Too. Everybody else is borrowing a lot? Me Too. Everybody else is borrowing very little? Me Too. We'll talk about what draws you to that Me Too corporate finance and why so many companies use it. So let's start with the cost of capital approach. In investment analysis, the cost of capital is a hurdle rate. Now, this is a little unfair because I'm going to jump forward 9 sessions to session 27. In session 27, I'm going to value the entire company. And don't worry, you actually have the tools to value entire companies right now. Because what you did on the Netflix case or in an investment analysis is estimate cash flows after taxes and discount them back at the cost of capital, come up with the net present value. I'm going to do that at the company-wide level. I'm going to look at the cash flows to the entire company. I'm going to discount those cash flows back at the cost of capital. And what I get as a present value is going to be the value of the entire company. So think of that equation, right? You got cash flows to the company, you got the cost of capital discounting the cash flows. Let's play a little game. Let's assume that I can keep the cash flows fixed and lower my discount rate, lower the cost of capital. What's going to happen to my value as a company? It's going to go up. At the limit, if I minimize my cost of capital, what have I done to my firm value? I've maximized it. You think, so what? What's the objective in corporate finance? Maximize the value of the business. So if that's my objective, I can get there by minimizing my cost of capital. You see where I'm going to go next? If I can change my mix of debt and equity, and by changing my mix of debt and equity, I can lower my cost of capital, my optimal debt ratio will be the one that minimizes my cost of capital. Sounds simple enough, right? So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take you through this process, a very quick review of cost of capital. We shouldn't need that review because you just did it in the quiz, but just in case you've forgotten, let's look at the ingredients that go into cost of capital. The cost of debt is the rate at which you can borrow money long-term today. So basically, you take the risk-free rate, you add a default spread, you come up with the cost of debt, you net out the tax benefit from it. So it's 1 minus the tax rate. The cost of equity is the expected return that diversified investors in your company will demand for investing in the company. The reason I use the word diversified is the only risk we bring into the cost of equity is the risk you cannot diversify away, captured with a beta. Cost of equity captures that. The cost of capital is a weighted average of those two numbers, weighted by their relative market values. So let's take a slight tangent here, and I'm going to ask you a question just to make sure you've got this concept nailed down. I kind of talked about this in the context of cost of equity when we did this way back in the 5th or 6th or 7th session. I talked about the CFO of the Asian company who told me that the cost of equity was only 1% because that's what he paid, or the company paid as a dividend yield. What's wrong with that assumption again? We kind of dealt with it, but let's make sure we... What are we missing when we use the dividend yield as the cost of equity? The rise in the stock price, price appreciation, right? Because if you take the dividend yield, Google's equity is zero cost, right? Because it doesn't pay any dividends. So what you're missing when you say that is the expected price appreciation. That's what we're getting when we take the risk-free rate plus beta times risk premium, we're getting that expected return. Now I'm going to ask you a second question, and this is a great interview question to ask. In fact, turn the tables on an interviewer sometime next year. He's giving you a really hard time. Ask him this question. Say, you look so wise. Kind of throw that in first. He's going to start preening. You look like an eminent banker. That'll make him even more ego-driven. And then ask him a question. Can you have a company where equity is actually cheaper than debt? I could say across companies, but for the same company, is it possible for equity to be cheaper than debt? In fact, I actually laid the foundation for that last session when I said the debt guy is always in front in line and the equity guy is last in line. So the debt guy asked for 7%. The equity guy should ask for 9%. Your last guy in line. I was lying, though. There's one exception to this rule. And I laid the foundation for it by taking you back another 10 sessions. Remember when we talked about betas? And I showed you the betas of lots of different companies. And I showed you a gold mining company. Remember what kind of beta that gold, Harmony Gold Mining was the company that I showed you. Remember what beta that company had? It had a negative beta. And why did it have a negative beta? Because the risk that drove it was gold prices, which cut against everything else in the market. So if you're a diversified investor, you would settle for a cost of equity that is actually less than the risk-free rate on that company because there's almost no market risk in that investment. Can that same gold mining company have high default risk? Sure, right? Gold prices are all over the place. If you're lending to that gold mining company, you might charge 10%. That's your exception. If you have a company where all of the risk is firm-specific risk and there's very little market risk, you could have a cost of equity that's low and a cost of debt that's high. And in that company, what the right mix of debt and equity is becomes trivial. What should a gold mining company fund its operations with? All equity all the time. Don't borrow money. You don't need to know any optimal capital structure to even carry this through. It just doesn't make sense for you to borrow money. So let's set this process up with a table that is almost 27 years old. This is actually from my very first corporate finance class in 1979. So I'd entered the MBA program, first semester of the MBA program. Corporate finance was your prerequisite, a core class, so sat in the class. I wanted to become a marketing major, but I was saved by this class. So during the course of this class, the corporate finance professor said, today we're going to talk about the optimal mix of debt and equity. And he set up a table for XYZ widget company. I've never understood this fixation with widgets in business schools. What the heck is a widget? What's the lifespan of a widget? How does it get depreciated? Where does it get used? I have no idea. So anytime anybody talks about widgets, it's an admission of a huge failure. You have no imagination. You have all these real products. Why the hell do you want to make up something that nobody's ever seen before? So already he was in the debit column with this, widget. Then he said, today we're going to talk about the right mix of debt and equity, and this is the table he showed. So I'll take you through what he told us, and I'll also tell you it was a deeply dissatisfying class for all of us. So he said, we're going to look at what happens to the cost of capital for this XYZ widget company as the debt ratio goes from 0% to 100%. So far, we're good. The first column is nailed down. Then he said, as the debt ratio goes up, the cost of equity will go up. And he told us a story. The story actually made sense. If you're the equity investor in a company and the company keeps borrowing money, your equity gets riskier, right? Why does it get riskier? Because you've got to make interest expenses. So basically, your equity gets riskier, so the cost of equity goes up. So the story made sense. Guy in the front row, wasn't me, put up his hand, says, Why is it going up the way it is? Take a look at that column. Basically, it went up 0.5%, then 0.6%, then point. To be quite honest, it looked like he'd made up the numbers. He said, don't worry about that. That's a just, you got the concept, right? Let's move on. So we moved on. Then he said, as you borrow more money, your cost of debt will go up. And again, the story made sense. If you're a bank lending money to a company, the more it borrows, the more risk the banker faces, so you charge you a higher interest rate. Again, it made sense. And the same guy in the front row, pain in the neck, you know, put up his hand and says, why is it going up the way it is? Because again, it looked like he'd made up the numbers. He said, don't worry about that. That's just a mechanical issue. Let's move on. So we're moving fast along. He comes to the fourth column and he computes his weighted average of his cost of equity and cost of debt, and he computes the cost of capital. What's my objective? Minimize the cost of capital. He says, 40%, that's your optimal debt ratio. Does everybody get it? We all looked at him and said, we do with this table. And to kind of show us that, you know, that this was the optimal, he actually said, if I hold the cash flows fixed at 200 million and I lower the cost of capital, the value is going to go up. That's a perpetual growth equation. And the last column, he computed what that value would be at a lower cost of capital. He looked at us still. We were still deeply disturbed at what he'd done. Disturbed is the wrong word because you never get that big an emotion when you're sitting in class. Mildly disturbed. He said, you guys look a little dim. We showed you in a different way. He took the cost of capital, he put it in a graph, and he said, now do you see what the optimal is? It's a low point on this graph. He was missing the point. Let me ask you a question. I've been working with Disney now for, what, 14 sessions, 15 sessions, right? 17 sessions. I miss how many sessions we've been doing this. How many points on this graph do I have for Disney right now? One. What's the one point I have? I have the existing debt ratio of the existing cost of capital. I don't have a graph. I have a point. How do I find a low point on a point? Do you see what the problem is? The table, if you give me the entire table for a company, anybody can find the optimal, including a six-year-old with a few bribes. Because you've got the decimals, kind of tough. No, but you find the low point on that. It's not, no, you don't need any skills. Getting that table for a real company is the challenge. I remember walking out of that class saying, I'm going to do this. I'm going to try to find a way to develop a table for a real company. So I'm going to take you through that process because that process is what you're going to see the end game of when I look at Disney today. So let's get that one point nailed down for Disney before we get too ambitious. So this is Disney's existing cost of capital. And to get the existing cost of capital, I started with the unlevered beta for Disney and worked up to a level. So this is essentially what we've already come up with. The cost of capital for Disney at its existing debt ratio is about 7.81%, a weighted average of its existing cost of equity and its existing cost of debt. That's where Disney is right now. What's the question I'm asking? If I change the debt ratio for Disney, could I lower this cost of capital? That's really how I want to frame this question. So what I'd like to do is go from this one cost of capital to a table that looks like the table for XYZ widget company. So let's set the table. What are the two numbers I need to compute a cost of capital? I need a cost of equity. I need a cost of debt, right? That's it. At every debt ratio, if I can give you a cost of equity and a cost of debt for Disney, I can compute the cost of capital. The way I've actually estimated cost of equity and cost of debt is actually going to allow me to finish the table, and here's why. I don't know whether you remember, but the way I computed the cost of equity for Disney is I broke it down into five businesses. I came up with this bottom-up unlevered beta based on the businesses it was in. Then I applied a debt-to-equity ratio to come up with a levered beta. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go back to that unlevered beta, and whenever you change your debt ratio, I'm going to compute what the beta would be at 10% debt, 20% debt, 30% debt, 40%, and I'm going to give you a levered beta at every debt ratio. Once I have a levered beta, I can get a cost of equity. So that half of the equation is going to be easy to do if you start with an unlevered beta. Now do you see why I abandoned regression betas again? If you have a regression beta, you're stuck with it. No matter what the debt ratio is, and you want to try, it's still 1.25. Here I get the freedom to change the beta. You remember how I got the cost of debt for Disney?
Anybody remember? I capitalized leases, but I needed a cost of debt to even capitalize the leases. I took the actual rating for Disney, which was single A. I used it to come up with a default spread of 1%. That then gave me a cost of debt that I used to capitalize leases and do the rest of that. Now, that's going to be a little difficult at other debt ratios. In fact, the first time I did this in the 90s, I actually sent a sheet of paper to an old student of mine who worked at S&P's ratings agency. And what I had was a blank a table with debt ratios from 0 to 90%. And I said, could you please fill in the ratings you would give Disney at all these other debt ratios? I got the fax page back like 2 minutes later. And here's what he had written in big letters across it. He said, do it and then we'll tell you. Ratings agencies are not going to telegraph what your rating will be at 60% debt, 80%, 90% debt. That's not their job. They'll tell you what the rating is now, but they're not going to give you hypothetical ratings. But I have a fallback, right? For those companies for which I could not get a rating, and even for those that I did get a rating, what was the other way that I came up with the cost of debt? What did I do? Do you remember? I did a synthetic rating. Remember that? Where I started with, what's the ratio I started with? An interest coverage ratio, which is operating income divided by interest expense. I came up with the coverage ratio. I went to a table, looked up your rating at that interest coverage ratio, gave you a cost of debt based on the rating. Do you see the pathway I'm going to use to try to come up with a rating for different debt ratios? As my debt ratio goes from 0 to 10 to 20 to 30 to 40 to 50 to 60 to 80 to 90%, my interest expense is going to climb, right? I have more debt, more interest expense. As my interest expense climbs, my interest coverage ratio is going to drop. As my interest coverage ratio drops and I go to that lookup table, my rating is going to go double A, single A, triple B, double B. My rating is going to change. As my rating changes, my default spread, my cost of debt will change. By the time I'm done, I'm going to be able to give you a cost of debt at every debt ratio for Disney. And once I'm done, you're going to have a table that looks just like XYZ widget company for your company. So enough talking, let's get to work. For Disney, here's what I'm going to start off with. I'm going to lay the groundwork. I need an unlevered beta. Do all those levered betas? So I'm going to reproduce a table from 150 pages ago from packet one. This is actually the table where I broke Disney down into five businesses. Remember that, where I took the comparable companies? And I came up with an unlevered beta for each business and a weighted average of those unlevered betas across those businesses of 0.9239. That's the unlevered beta for Disney. Why do I need that? Without that, I can't do the levered betas at different debt ratios. You're saying, what if I can't break my company down? If you really want to stick with a regression beta, dangerous thing to do, but if that's all you have, you can unlever the regression beta and use that as your unlevered beta. That's the other choice, but you need an unlevered beta. That's the first thing I did. The second thing I did was, for my interest coverage ratio, what's the number in the numerator? The operating income. I need to know how much operating income Disney has available before I get too carried away letting them borrow money. So here's what the operating income looked like for Disney. And the most recent 12 months, the operating income that Disney had, adjusted for the fact that I'm treating leases as a debt expense, is $10,032 million. $10 billion in operating income available. That's going to become my numerator in my interest coverage ratio as I change my debt ratio. So I know the unlevered beta. I know how much money or how much earnings they have to play with. Those are going to be the drivers that I'm going to use to come up with the cost of equity and the cost of debt. So let's start with the cost of equity. What is the unlevered beta? 0.9239, right? Let's start with the easiest cost of capital. At a 0% debt ratio, what will the cost of capital for Disney be? It'll be the cost of equity based on what beta? At 0%, it'll be the unlevered beta. So take the 0.9239, you come up with the cost of equity. The 8.07% you get as your cost of equity will also be your cost of capital. Let me pause right there. Do you remember what their cost of capital was before, right now? 7.81%. So if I asked you, should Disney pay off all its debt, what should your answer be? No, because it'll increase the cost of capital to 8.07%. So now let's look at 10% debt. With a 10% debt ratio, remember I have $10 of debt for every $90 of equity, my debt to equity ratio becomes 10 over 90, which is 11.11%. My levered beta now is going to be higher than my unlevered beta because I borrowed money. It goes up to 0.9895. My cost of equity goes to 8.45%. That's only the cost of equity. I still haven't talked about the debt. So the cost of capital still has to be computed. But at a 10% debt ratio, you can see the cost of equity goes up. I do the 20, the 30, the 40. And as the debt ratio climbs, notice my cost of equity goes from 8% to 38.69%. It's not as neat as that XYZ widget company table, which went 0.5, 0.6, 0.7. Nothing in the real world moves like that. So this is exactly what you should expect. You should expect the cost of equity to not just rise, but rise at higher and higher rates as you move down the table. Any questions? Yeah. I'm sorry? How did I get what? Oh, the previous cost of capital, it's 7.81% is today. I'm just doing cost of equity here. Right? The only time the cost of equity is going to be equal to the cost of capital is at 0% debt. The 8.07% cost of equity is also going to be the cost of capital. So what I said was, if you told me you were going to pay off all your debt as Disney, you're actually making yourself worse off. Because your cost of capital right now is 7.81%. It'll actually rise to 8.07% if you went to an all-equity funded company. So I'm my cost of equity. Let's talk about the cost of debt. The cost of debt is a little involved. So what I'm going to do is take you through this process manually. That sounds like a strange word to use. You're saying as opposed to what? I'm actually going to send you an Excel spreadsheet after class today where I'll let you plug the numbers in for your company and it'll do the synthetic ratings and the cost of debt for your company at every debt ratio from 0 to 90. It'll be like magic. And you'll be tempted to view it as a black box. But what I want you to do is actually look at how I do it manually because this is what I've put into the Excel spreadsheet. So what I'm going to try to do is estimate the cost of debt for Disney at a 10% debt ratio. So let's see how this process gets started. First thing I do is I take the market value of equity today and the market value of debt today. So the 121,878 is the share price times number of shares in Disney today. The $15,961 million is actually the market value of debt today, and it includes two components. One is the market value of interest-bearing debt, which is about $13.2 billion. What's the other? The leases, the present value of the leases. Once I've decided to walk in through that lease door, from that point on, whenever I talk about debt, that will include leases. The collective value of the company right now is $137.9 billion. So you're saying, why do you need to know that? If you go to a 10% debt ratio, the first question I'm going to ask you is how much dollar debt will you need to get to a 10% debt ratio? 10% of $137.839 billion is $13,784 million. So the dollar debt you see at a 10% debt ratio is just 10% of the overall value of the firm. So what am I doing? I'm going from no debt to $13.784 billion. So I'm borrowing $13.784 billion, right? That's money coming into the firm. Now this is a problem. Why is it a problem? Because if I just bring the money in, my balance sheet is now going to get bigger. I have $13.8 billion more of cash to spend. And if I put it into projects, I have two things going on. One is I've changed my debt ratio, and the second is I've taken a project. And the project could have a positive net present value. So what I want to do is when I borrow money, I want to make sure that money leaves the company almost immediately. There are two ways I can make it leave the company. I borrowed $13,784 million. I can either pay a dividend of $13,784 million, which reduces my equity by $13,784 million, or I can buy back shares, which reduces my number of shares and the value of equity. Do you see what I'm doing? I'm raising the debt and lowering the equity. It's called a recapitalization and keeping the assets what they are. So now I have a dollar debt. Because I'm not messing with investing this money back into the projects, my EBITDA, my depreciation, my EBIT don't change because they're still the same projects. They're the same theme parks, the same movies, the same broadcasting shows. They stay unchanged. My operating income is $10,032 million at a 10% debt ratio. Now comes the first key number. I need to know what my interest expenses will be on that $13,784 million debt. To get interest expenses, what do I need? I need an interest rate. So I multiply the dollar debt by an interest rate to come up with an interest expense. The interest expense I come up with is $434 million. You divide the $10,032 million by the $434, you come up with an interest coverage ratio of almost 23. Now turn to the next page, because I have the lookup table. And with the 23 interest coverage ratio, your rating should be AAA, and your cost of debt should be 3.15%. I'm going to describe the sequence. There's actually a problem in the sequence. Let's see if you can catch it. I start off by estimating how much dollar debt. I can see you've caught it, or you're going to... So hold on a minute. I'll let you be the first one to catch it. I start with the dollar debt. I multiply the dollar debt by an interest rate to come up with an interest expense. I divide the EBIT by the interest expense to come up with a coverage ratio. I use the coverage ratio to come up with a rating. I use the rating to come up with an interest rate. What's the problem there? Exactly. This is the chicken and the egg problem in capital structure. And unlike the chicken and the egg problem, to which I don't think there's a known solution, which came, you know the chicken and the egg problem, right? Which came first, the chicken or the egg? And people who had nothing to do with their lives spend hours debating this. But this one's actually worth debating. So there is a problem, because I need the interest rate to get the interest expense, and I need the interest expense to get the interest rate. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to show you how I did this. You're actually going to help me do this at a 30% debt ratio, and you're going to see how we're going to get around this problem. So ready? Move forward two pages. We're going to try to compute the cost of debt for Disney at a 30% debt ratio. So let's start at the top. Your debt ratio is 30%. What's your debt to equity ratio? You have $30 of debt for $70 of equity. 30 divided by 70 is like 42.86%, something like that. So somebody with a calculator, I need some help here. So somebody with a calculator, help me out here. Nobody has a calculator? Abacus, nothing? 42.8%. Good. So let's enter that in. As we go through, I want you to enter the numbers, because I want to make sure the numbers get nailed down. You can go back home and check the numbers. So 30 divided by 70 is 42.8%. So that's your debt to equity ratio. Now let's get to the dollar debt. At a 20% debt ratio, at a 10% debt ratio, at $13,784. At a 20% debt ratio, that rose to $27,568. At a 30% debt ratio, I'm going to add another $13,784 million. You see where I'm getting the $13,784 million? That's each 10% increment is 10% of the total firm value. How much dollar debt do I have? 41,302, something like that? I can cheat here. It's 41,352 million. So basically what's happening is I'm adding another 10% installment to my debt. My debt goes from 27,562 to 41,352 million. Everybody with me so far? I've got 41.3 billion debt. The next three numbers are easy. What's my EBITDA, DA, and EBIT going to be? The same, because I'm essentially assuming that I'm doing this recapitalization. So copy down 12,570, 2,485, and 10,032. Now we come to that cell. Do you see the problem you face? What's the interest rate? You don't have one yet. And you have $41,352 million in debt. So I'm going to cheat. It's completely unrealistic. But I know what the interest rate was at a 20% debt ratio. I know the bank won't lend me money at that rate, but let's act like they did. Let's say they were really stupid and lend me at the old rate. If I were able to borrow money at 3.15%, 3.15% of $41,352 million is $1,302 million. That's my interest expense at a 3.15% rate. You see where I get the $1,302 million? Take 41,352 times 3.15%, and you can come up with $1,302 million. What's the next step? Divide the EBIT by the interest expense. I come up with an interest coverage ratio of 7.5. Once I get the interest coverage ratio, I go to the table. And with an interest coverage ratio of 7.5, what should my rating be? It should be AA, and the interest rate I should be paying is 3.45%. Do you see the problem we're facing? The interest expense I computed using a 3.15% rate, and now I'm saying, hey, I'm sorry, but the rate you should really be paying is 3.45%. So what's the fix now? Why do you think I have a second column in here that says iteration 2? So what are you going to recompute in the second iteration? You're going to take 41,352 and multiply by 3.45%. You're going to come up with 700 and, I'm going to cheat, I'm sorry, 868 million in interest expenses. That's 3.45% times the dollar debt. That interest, that 868 million, if I divide the EBIT by that, I'm sorry, it can't be 868 million. 1,427 million, sorry, 1,427 million. It's higher because of a higher interest rate. With that interest expense, my interest coverage ratio drops to 7.02. I very gingerly turn to the previous page. And I hope and pray what hasn't happened, that I haven't slipped a notch. If I slip a notch, what do I have to do? I have to open an iteration 3. I have some good news and I have some bad news. I'll give you the bad news first. Sometimes you have to do 3 iterations. I've never had to do more than 3. The good news is, even if you had to do 3 iterations for each debt ratio, that's 3 times 10, right? 0%, 10%. It'll probably take an hour and a half to do. Let's say it's a $150 billion company, and you could save the company $6 billion in value. How much do you value your time at? If it's less than $4 billion an hour, you should still do it manually. It's not rocket science. Anybody can do it, essentially. But I'll give you an even quicker fix. In Excel, if you've gone into calculation options in Excel, you ever gone in there, all those dark spaces in Excel you try not to go into? You open calculation options, there's a little box that says iterations. If you've never seen it, find it. If you put a check on that box, you know what it allows Excel to do? Do what we did manually. It allows it to go circular. It allows it to run iterations. And the default when you check that is Excel runs 2,000 iterations. How many did I say the most I ever needed? 3. This is a little bit of overkill, but Excel runs at 3, and afterwards it just keeps running, even though it doesn't have to run. So when you open the spreadsheet I'm going to send you, don't try to fix it. What I mean by that is when you first open the spreadsheet, you know how Excel, when it has circular reasoning, starts drawing lines all over the spreadsheet saying, oh my God, it's going to blow up on you. Don't do anything now. Danger, danger. Red lights start flashing. Yeah. Skull bones start coming at you. Just go in and check that iteration box in Excel and everything is going to be okay. Because you need that. This is not a bug. It's a feature. You need the circular reasoning for it to work. Because at the end of the process, here's what you're going to end up with. I'm sorry. You're going to end up with the dollar debt. You're going to end up with the interest expense at each debt level. Come to coverage ratio rating. And so these are the end iterations. So I've done this for every debt ratio. If I'd done this manually, I'd have to do 3 iterations for those that I needed. But I let Excel do it. So as you notice, as the debt goes up, my interest expense goes up more than proportionately. Why does it go up more than proportionately? Because as my debt goes up, my interest rate also starts rising. So my interest expense gets larger and larger. As my interest expense goes up, my coverage ratio, which starts at 23, drops. No surprise. I borrow more money, my coverage ratio gets worse. As my coverage ratio gets worse, look at what happens to my bond rating. It starts at AAA, and by the time I get to 90% debt, I'm a single C rated company. As my rating drops, my cost of debt rises. No surprise. There's one final adjustment. I have to multiply by 1 minus the tax rate, right? I multiply by 1 minus the tax rate. I'm using the 36.1% I've been using so far until I get to 70% debt. What do you think happens? My tax rate magically seems to go down. Is this a good thing or a bad thing to have lower tax rates in this particular table? It's a bad thing because the tax rate actually is what allows me to capture the tax benefits. So if there's a lower tax rate, I'm saying you're not getting as much of a tax benefit from debt at 70, 80, and 90%. What do you think is happening? How does the tax benefit of debt work when you have interest expenses? How does it save you taxes? If you have enough taxable income, it'll save. So what's happening at 70% debt, very simply, is your interest expense actually gets bigger than your operating income. And I'm saying enough. Yeah, the operating income in this case is 10,032 million. I put a cap on that. So once you hit your interest expense, it's 10,032. I can't get you any more tax benefits. You have no more income. So what happens at 70, 80, and 90% is my interest expense hits the ceiling. The tax benefits hit a ceiling, but my interest expense keep climbing. So in fact, the most I can get in tax benefits is 10,032 times the 36.1%. And if my interest expense rises to 11,096, which is what it does at 70% debt, my effective tax savings get smaller. So as you get to 70, 80, and 90% debt, that's what's happening to your tax rate. So I'm going to close with a table which looks a lot like the XYZ widget company table. But this is for Disney. The cost of equity comes from the fact that I'm levering the unlevering, so the levered beta goes up, the cost of equity goes up. The cost of debt goes up partly because my rating starts to drop and partly because I start to lose those tax benefits at 70, 80, and 90. So what's the optimal debt ratio for Disney? Huh? 40%. And I'm going to leave you with a final anecdote. I've been using this example now for a couple of years, and about 9 months ago, I was doing this for a banker's re-education program. This is when bankers forget the basics, so I had to come in and talk to bankers who'd been around from their jobs 15 or 20 years and try to remind them of the basics. There's this one guy in this class who did not want to be there. And he made it very obvious he did not want to be there. First day he came and sat in the last row. He put his feet up on the chairs in front of him, opened up the Wall Street Journal very ostentatiously, and read the same page for 2 days. That's what bugged me. So why didn't he at least turn the page? Then we get to the section, and I put this table up, and he puts up his hand. And here's the question he asks. Can we safely assume that the optimal debt ratio for all companies, because remember that XYZ widget company also had a 40%? He says, can we safely assume that the optimal debt ratio for all companies is 40%? No. You can't safely assume it. So next session when we start, we're going to dig into why Disney has a 40% optimal and why other companies might have different optimals. So I will see you next week.
Understand your question, then I'm confused why we got taken off the point in the 10 point in the 10 year when we didn't add that in, and we only added in as an assumption to say if we did need to do
this. You did it only as a what if, so you didn't do it in the actual cash flows?
Yes, and we discussed that.